today we're going to continue with the next big thing in compiler construction, which is now that we have analyzed the lexical and syntactical structure of our code, is the next level analysis phase, which is more than just plain syntax, which is semantic analysis. So, no. Let's go back. So, what is the semantic analysis all about? Well, the thing is that with the help of the constructs that you have learned so far, which is this lexical analysis and syntactical analysis, you can already perform a lot of checks what your input actually matches as rules. For example, as lexical rules, whether you have formed your constants in the right way, or the syntactical rules, whether you have put all your special tokens in the right place in order to belong together. But even with those two types of rules and checks, you are still able to produce syntactically completely valid programs, which all the while still do not make any sense. So there's still work to do in the analysis phase of the compiler, which goes further than just a syntactical analysis. And the idea is to post-process the result of your syntactical analysis with some further means in order to get rid of these errors. So typical things that you can associate that still happen after just the syntactic analysis are kind of the type-related things. So what is the problem with types? Well, you have to make sure that certain identifiers or variables or function names or whatever have been for once declared at some point. You want to have information about what, for example, what the format in memory for this slot memory should be, or how much space you need in memory for that. So you need some kind of declaration before you can start using these things, because you need to initialize slots in memory somewhere for these type of constructs. So what you should make sure of is that your identifiers are declared somewhere or defined. So that's the first point. The second point is that once you have declared them in a certain type, what you also want to make sure is that they are used with operations that are actually defined for this kind of type. So a string concatenation, for example, is something that does not make sense for doubles per se in every programming language. There's, of course, languages that are designed in a different way, such that you don't have to declare your variables before you use them, or such that the there's type conversions going on everywhere, such that all the operators that you can use are actually meaningful at some point. But in general, the type-related things are the ones that need a little bit of work afterwards. And if you switch to language concepts who don't have this type declarations and type correct use of variables, then you will have to, need for a few other semantic properties in your code. So there's still work to do in the semantic phase. What you also find semantical analysis useful for is in cases where you want to not to just create some code that does your work, but code that does your work in a more optimal way. So there's ways to perform optimizations by doing semantic analysis on the syntax tree, and what might be feasible to do, for example, constant folding or something, where you just go through your syntax tree and collect subtrees that can be collapsed into a single value and use this one instead, for example. That would be an example for meaningful semantic analysis. Yeah. Of course. So the general idea of how semantic analysis can work with just the syntax tree is that for certain concerns of your program correctness or semantics, you introduce attributes to the different spots in your syntax tree for different nodes, and you try to fill them with the right values for their respective concerns. You've actually already seen the application of that, but just not under the general name. So what the name for that is in general, attribute grammars. This is a kind of a concept that can be exploited in several ways. You can have kind of automatic systems that try to compute all these attributes for you. You can use them for kind of manually post-process your syntax trees. So attribute grammars, what are they about? Well, the thing is that for syntax trees, you have certain properties that have to be computed along paths within such trees, and the computations that have to be performed along that path are actually dependent on the different nodes that this path goes through. So there's the notion of kind of local computations, which is computations that are done while passing one of these subtrees. And the way how you specify these kind of computations is that for one of these subtrees, you specify for each of the nodes that are part of that subtree how the value of one of their attributes depends or is computed from other of these attributes. So, that's what these attributes are about in general. What are attributes grammars in formal point of view? Well, attribute grammar is just a context-free grammar extended by a set of attributes for each of the non-terminals and terminals, so for each of the symbols, together with equations on these attributes which are dependent on the actual production with which they are associated. So we call them local attribute equations. So you can give an attribute grammar by listing all your productions, and for each of these productions, you open up a list of attribute equations. Yeah, and the idea to then compute with these attribute grammars is that you start to evaluate all these attribute equations that you give into the system. In order for that to work, you should also adhere to some kind of sequence in which you evaluate these attributes, as there might be complex dependencies between those nodes, and you might have to stick to a certain order in evaluating them. You already have seen examples for attribute systems without knowing that. If you think back to the first days of our lecture where we have talked about doing lexical analysis, we were just giving you, throwing you some trees, and we said that we would now start to compute certain properties of these trees, which we labeled with a certain name. We had, more in detail, we had the syntax tree of regular expressions, even on our slides. And we, for example, what we computed on these were the attributes for emptiness or maybe emptiness of a subtree. So if you think back on how we computed with syntax trees for regular expressions, well, what we did is we started at the bottom, and then we had to somehow come up with values for the maybe emptiness of all the other nodes. And what we said is that there's a certain order in which we have to evaluate to compute these attributes. And the idea was that we, for the leaves, the value for the emptiness would be constant, and we would have local computation rules in order to come up with the attributes for the inner nodes. And what we did was we computed the values of the inner nodes dependent on their children, so that if we computed the whole thing from bottom up or with a depth first search in post order, we would be able to compute the attributes for the whole tree. So what you've seen there is already some kind of special case or instance of attribute system here. Yeah, what we had is the first post-order traversal for that. For the leaves, we had kind of constants, and the inner nodes were computed from one or the other. In this case, what we had was that there's kind of a general concept for this for the whole attribute empty to be computed from bottom up, and attributes in general, which are only dependent on the values of attributes of child nodes of each subtree, a special case of attributes which we call synthetic attributes. And that is what our empty attribute actually was. It is a synthetic attribute. We all also have the kind of contrary concept, which is, well, can you remember the other one that we had? Well, we had to go top down to. Next one, for example, yeah, the next states were the ones that were computed from top to bottom. So most of the ones that we have seen were actually synthetic. The other one was top-down, which also has a special name, which is inherited, because it comes from the parents, I have to say. So, these are two special names for attributes. Apart from that, what we have seen is that the local dependencies are just dependent on the type of the node. The way how we specified our dependencies or local dependencies in the case of the empty computation was that we have given special equalities where we gave the actual name of the right hand side of the production, and we kind of intuitively matched these names with names that we could reproduce on the other side of the equation. Well, that was at that point something which we introduced to process the whole algorithm a little bit faster in class. But if we approach the whole system from a more general point of view, and in order to come up with a few formal computations on that, we now introduce a kind of general formalism on how to express equalities on attributes of a tree. So what we would do is that we would specify for each of the productions a set of equalities where we would use certain names to specify the attribute identity, which is in this case, for example, this empty, and we would then use in order to specify whether we would refer to the attribute for the subtree's root or for the subtree's children, we would use then numerical indices for you. For example, if we have such a substructure where we would have empty attributes all over this thing, we would give numbers for the different instances of this attribute. So this one we would call the zeroth, because that's the parent. The parent will always carry a zeroth, and then we will just enumerate all the branches that we have for such a subtree and use the numbers there as index. So the leftmost one is just the first instance, and the rightmost one is the nth instance of the attribute. So it's just some kind of generalized way to speak about these things, and this facilitates work later on a little bit. So if we want to express the whole thing for our example of the empty attribute, then this would look like the following. So here we would have the whole collection of empty attributes, now in the new way of expressing that, where we have each of the production types. We have abbreviated them here on this side by just using their most typical thing, like the operator in the middle or the unary operator behind. So for each of these productions, we give equations now between those different instances of the attribute. And what we mean with that is, for example, here that we compute the each time today we compute the empty attribute for the parent of a concatenation by performing the logical AND between the first child with the second child. So that is the kind of way how we specify these equation systems now. Just having the local dependencies of these attribute equations won't help us much in the long run. What we actually need to get all the values for our attributes is some kind of global algorithm that not only knows local dependencies, but the dependencies between several subtrees, which are even might be a little bit further away from each other than just one step in this parent-child relation. So in order to construct such an algorithm, we have to determine a sequence in which the nodes of the tree are actually visited, and within each of these nodes which of the equations we should actually evaluate while we are visiting this subtree. And this evaluation strategy has to be something that is actually compatible in some way with the dependencies of the attributes. In order to visualize that for our lecture, we will use the concept of local dependency graphs. We could also specify these dependencies just by enumerating the relations between the different attributes, but that's something that is probably quite bothersome to read. So we will do it in a more graphical way by introducing these local dependency graphs, or formally these dependencies D of production variant P. And what we will use for visualization is that we will draw kind of nodes for each of these attributes, and we will use arrows in the between attributes that are related in the way that they have actually a direction. And the direction is that the arrow points in the direction where the information flows. So in the example above here, where below here, where we have the graph for the empty attribute for alternation, we will have information flowing from two child attributes to the parent node. So that's how we would have to read that. In general, probably not in general yet, for the simple example that we've seen so far, we could just say that a depth-first post-order traversal was something that was actually possible in the case of computing this maybe-empty attribute for syntax trees of regular expressions. In general, variable dependencies can be much more complex, especially when you think of the other attributes that we had for the regular expressions. If you remember them correctly, you will recognize them here in their more generic kind of notation. And for the first few ones, there's not so much of complexity added to the ones to the way that the attributes were defined for just the empty thing. We have for the start production, we just map the attributes from parent to child for empty and first, and for next we will have just a constant. And the other simple one is the one for the terminal X, for which we have empty being a constant if the whole system is if the attached constant is the empty string, and as first we had the equation that it is actually the character in case that it is not the empty string. Okay, so these are the ones that are not so complex so far. But as soon as we start to look at the other attribute systems, it gets a little bit more complex. We have a lot more of things going on, as we see down there in the dependency graph. Here we have the empty being dependent on both of the children, as we had so far. First, kind of the same. And then we have next, and this time next is something which is actually going the other way around. Next is flowing downwards in the control flow graph. So the information flow going from top down here in these cases. That's still not very complicated so far, but we can now mix references of attributes into other attribute equations, like we see here. We are still in the same notation. We only have these numerical selectors for the different instances of the attributes, but now we have different attributes, attribute names in a single equation. So for empty, we have said that everything is fine. We can, it's just a simple case. For first, we now see a little bit more of complexity here. First now is referring to the empty and the first kind of attributes. So for evaluating first zero is the parent. So for evaluating this one, for computing this one, we have references to empty one. So empty of the first child is something on which we our computation depends, as well as potentially we need to query first of the second example. So there's I've marked the wrong things here. So for first, for computing first of the parent, we need to refer to first of the first child, which was this one, and then we would go over to empty of the first child. So this one also contributes to computing the first attribute here, and then there's first of the second child, which is this one. So these three components are actually connected now. And what makes it even more difficult is that the next computation now also introduces new dependencies. Next computation for is now one that we The next computation is now one that we perform for we perform for each of the children separately. So next of the first children is now depending on first of the second children. So this one, and we see this is already marked. So there's already kind of a another dependency going on here. So the first of the second is first attribute of the second child is now something that both the computation of first and the computation of next is in some way dependent. So this one. Then there's also the empty attribute of the second child, something that we should consider. So this one also has to be considered for next, and next of the parent is something that we need to check for. So you see there's a lot of dependencies working together in order to perform all these local computations, and now there's already a lot of a mess here in this dependency graph. And of course, there's other dependencies here for the clean star and the question mark thing. Okay, so each of these alone are probably quite easy to see how to evaluate, but you have to keep in mind that those are appearing connected to each other inside a complete syntax tree. So not only the local dependencies are ones you have to consider, but there's also, if you connect them to each other, you might introduce new paths between them. And this might lead to even more dependencies from one to each other. So creating or computing an evaluation of all these attributes is something which is quite difficult to do, and it is, and especially if you want to give a static strategy for an order in which you want to evaluate all these attribute equations, then you're challenged quite a lot. So, what you might ask yourself is there any chance at all that I succeed? Is there a static evaluation strategy which I can apply for all concrete instances of syntax trees that match my attribute grammar? And yeah, the next thing would be to say, which one is it? Well, turns out that you can try to compute all the dependencies of your attribute system, and also if you can compute all these dependencies in there, you can try to check whether it is possible to go in a circle through all these dependencies. This would be kind of the killer argument against a static evaluation strategy, because if you have a circle in there, well, you there's no general way to say that the whole system is computable. And turns out that if you want to perform such a check whether cyclic dependencies can appear in any of the syntax trees that adheres to a certain grammar, well, the only thing that is currently known is an exponential time algorithm. Well, that's already a few years ago that the whole this has come out, but still, that's something which is quite bothersome for us. So, what are ideas out of that dilemma? Well, what we can do is we can kind of give up and let the user specify a strategy and hope that it will actually work. And if we detect that there's a circle in this specific syntax tree, we can just bail out or hope that the system stabilizes and just bail out after a few iterations of the whole system. Or we could try to determine a dynamic strategy. That's something that we will see a little bit later on. And in some cases, we will be quite successful with that. And as always, or as quite frequent in computer science, there's always the possibility to not tackle the general kind of problem, but a subclass of this problem, which might turn out to be easier to compute. So our first thing would now be to find our way around this exponential time algorithm for checking for cyclic dependencies based on our attribute grammar, but rather try to find some kind of weaker property of our attribute grammar that nevertheless allows us to safely determine to safely say that there will be a static evaluation strategy. So if our test says we can safely try to perform one, then there also there will definitely be a room for a static evaluation strategy. Yeah, but if our algorithm says, well, there's no static evaluation strategy, well, our algorithm might have produced a bit of an error on that side, and there might actually still be a static evaluation strategy, but we were just not able to find proof for that. So, what is the idea for that? Well, the idea would be not to show that we have acyclic attribute dependencies in our attribute grammar, but to prove that the grammar is strongly acyclic, which is kind of an over-approximation. So the idea would be that we would try to compute the kind of a global view on what dependencies appear for all possible syntax trees, but we would not perform a precise subsumption of all the dependencies that might globally be valid, but we would speed up our test by over approximate. So in some cases we would make an error on one side, but still come up with we might come up with more dependencies that actually appear. But still, if we find that the whole system is cycle free, then we would still be good. So how do we perform such a strongly acyclic attribute dependency gathering? Well, this needs a few kind of helper things before we come to the actual gathering phase. So I would beg you to stay with me for this slide. There's a little bit of formal specifications here on that slide. But in the next slides, we will then show how to apply them on a concrete example. So we need a few helper structures at first. In general, we will deal with relations of attributes. So what these dependencies can be just represented as such relations. So and relations are in general sets of tuples. So what we will talk about in a lot of times is sets of tuples. For example, for the first operation, which I've called redecoration, this is something that works as with a set of relations as input. And what it will just do is it will kind of rename or redecorate the tuples that it finds in there. And the way how it is renamed is given as parameters. So we will give it a kind of specifier for a certain variant of production, which we call P here, to introduce a new prefix for the tuple partners, and an index which will be used afterwards to refer to either parents or children or whatever is necessary. We'll just take the number of which of these positions to refer from the parameters here. So in the case that you see here, we will for each of the tuples that are inside of this set of tuples, which is these relations, we will just add the prefix for the production and in front, and we will add the this index expression I at as a suffix for the whole thing. So it's just a kind of renaming or decoration thing. We will need this in order to take relations that we have computed at one point and fit it in a certain position of another dependency tree. That's why we need to attach a name for the specific production variant to it, as well as an index to say at which position we want to fit it into a specific dependency tree. We will see how that works later on. The next helper function that we need is the projection, and this is kind of just a filter on a set of tuples. So what we will filter with our projection pi zero is we will only consider those relations that are actually talking about parental attributes, attributes that are specified for the parent node of a subtree. So that's why they will only be taken over into our final set if they are direct relations between parent attributes. So this is just two helpers. One, to fit in relations into a dependency graph, and the other one to filter just the top line, which is just about the parental attributes. So these are helpers. And then what we're going to do with them is, for each production, we will perform a certain construction. So for each of these production variants is kind of interpreted in a certain way. That is something that we denote with these semantic brackets here, with a sharp symbol. That's a reinterpretation of what is performed inside. So that is the reinterpretation of a certain production. And this is considered to be a function of several parameters. These parameters are considered to be relations, as sets of tuples. And what we're going to do with that is we will reinterpret this production by taking the dependencies, the local dependencies that are inflicted by the local attribute equations of that specific production. And we will put in, the parameters that we got from over here, those parameters. And we will adapt these parameters such that they fit into the specific slots that are inside these local dependencies for each of the right-hand sides of such a production. And we do that by using these redecoration expressions here. So we will add the respective names for the productions as prefixes and the indices for the specific symbols as numerals here. So what we will have achieved by that is that we have plugged certain relations into the local dependencies. Now the operation continues with performing the transitive closure. It's the blue part here with a little plus there. So you have local dependencies. There is a lot of relations between these attributes. We have plugged in other relations. And then we're doing the transitive closure, which will lead to a lot of new arrows introduced between those. And especially the ones that we're after is new relations for the top line, for the parental attributes. Because after we have performed this transitive closure, we will then project everything away and just treat the parental attributes. This is our main thing which we use in order to plug in relations that come from somewhere else, somewhere from the top or somewhere from the bottom, and then perform the connections locally and via this transitive closure project the whole thing to just one line of dependencies between just parental attributes. And with that, we will interconnect all possibilities that are offered via the grammar and interconnect them all with each other and perform our fitting of the new relations into their slots and then compacting them and projecting them on just the root level. And we will do that in a certain way. What we'll do is we will introduce a whole system which we call R. And this system of relations maps each of the symbols that we keep in our grammar. And, for each of these symbols, we will look at every variant of production that we offer for that symbol. So for that symbol, there's different ways of having or different kinds of productions that we have in our grammar. And each of them has a certain right-hand side. And for each of these right-hand sides, there's other symbols, x1 to xk, for which there are relations between the attributes. And what we will do is we will take the relations that we have gathered in our computation so far, which is, are stored in this map R under the entries of their symbol names, and plug them into our special interpretation of this instance of the production. This will lead to all the relations that we have gathered for these symbols so far to be put into the slots where they belong. And that is something that we have given by just the position here. So this is why they will end up in their respective parameter place, which will then, in the end, adapt them to the right positions in the local dependency graph. And in the end, we will remove everything that we have added so far and just use the compacted representation of this transitive closure of all the dependencies that we have had here, and just keep the top line, which is just the relations on the parental node, and continue. And we'll iterate as long as there's still change in the system. So the graphs will grow from time to time, and we will end up in a system where we have captured all the possible or all the relations that are actually induced by the system. This algorithm will maybe run quite some time, but in the end it will actually terminate at some point because, well, you only have a finite number of attributes possible for each of these symbols, and as soon as you have interconnected all of them, well, there's nothing that can change anymore. So as the system only grows, we will at some point reach the actual attribute dependencies at some point. Okay, and the way how we can now detect whether there's a cycle in involved or not is that we look for each of the production variants and check whether in the static dependencies, together with all the possible relations for the slots that are free in these local dependencies, when we join them all, when there's no cycle, then the attribute grammar for which we, from which we generated that system is actually cycle-free. Okay, there was a lot of formal definitions there. So let's have a look at an example. You'll see that it's not as difficult as it sounds. It's just you need kind of sub-programs in order to specify that thing. That's why we had all these functions involved. So, strong acyclic grammar test. Let's have an example of a grammar, which is the grammar that produces L from S and A or B from L. So it's a pretty simple grammar. And let's assume that we have given a certain attribute equalities for these grammars, so it's considered to be a whole system, and I've spared you the details of the equalities and just put the graphic representation of these dependencies on there. So there's the first production, S goes to L, which has these dependencies. So there's the attribute H, which is flowing from the first child to the parent, as well as to the attribute K. And there's the attribute J, which is flowing also to the parent, as well as to the attribute I. And then we have for the symbol L, we have two productions. So there's this production and this production, and both of them have different dependencies in their attribute equalities. There's a dependency of J from K for the first variant, and the dependency for, of H from I for the second variant. So That's for a start. Now, what do we have to do in order to determine whether we have a cycle in there? Well, what we need to do is we need to compute these global dependency sets. So let's start with that. What do we need to do for that? There are several steps involved. At first, we have to, what we need to perform is the computation of these maps R for each of these symbols. So let's start just with the L, for example. Here we have to reinterpret the first variant for L and the second variant for L, and apply them to the so far accumulated dependency sets for the for their right-hand sides. However, the right-hand sides are terminal symbols, so they do not contribute any dependencies. There is just nothing that can come below A or B, so there's no actual dependency here. So our parameter lists are actually empty, so there's nothing here to do. So we don't need to plug anything in to redecorate anything. We're done with the first phase. We can go over to perform the transitive closure of all the relations that are just in the static dependency graph. So yeah, it's pretty easy for the graphs that we have here because they're pretty simple. There's just one edge here and one edge here, and in each of them there's no other edge, so we cannot. There's no need to add any further edges because there cannot be anything combined. So we're already done with the transitive closure, and now the algorithm still goes further. But as we have seen, the condition for us to yield that there is a cycle in there is just talking about plugging the global relations that we have gathered so far into the local dependencies. And when there is a cycle there already, we can just yield, well, there's a cycle, we don't have to go anywhere further. So in our case, well, there's no cycles in any of them, so this check is there's actually no cycles, so we can just skip that and go further. Now we have to apply pi zero. That was now that we have looked at the transitive closure of the whole system, we can reduce our point of view to just the parental nodes, the parental attributes, and project everything else away. So we take away everything below and just talk about the transitions on the edges of the attributes of the parent node. And now what we have is that we have gathered so far two possible relation sets for our symbol L. The one is from K to J, the other one is from I to H. So we're good so far. Now there's still another production for which we have to determine the global dependencies. So this one is the one that belongs to symbol S. This for that we have to compute reinterpretations of all their productions. In this case, we only have one production that expands S. So yeah, here we go. And this one actually has a non-terminal as right-hand side, so we actually have a parameter here, which is the which is the set of global relations for this symbol S. So, what? How do we compute this function? Well, what we've seen as steps that we have to go through is that if well, it's a few slides ago, but I'll retrace it in the order that we will actually do that. So we will now start with redecorating the... I think there's a mistake on there. Has anyone seen it? Well, here, parameter is not S, for example, because that's what we actually want to compute. What we see is that we have L here. So what we need is L as the symbol from which we get our dependencies. So, what we want to do is now we want to take our first parameter, which is all the dependencies that we have computed so far for our subtrees of type L, and adapt them so that they fit here into this slot. There's an L, which can be instantiated with different possibilities. So we have to adapt the summaries that we have accumulated so far for L such that it fits into there. And formally, this is performed by putting the right indices as suffix into the relations, as well as putting the right prefix to denominate that should belong into production S goes to L. So that's what formally is actually achieved. What practically this means in this graphic would mean that this L should go, for example, there, as well as this L should also go there at some point. Okay, the next thing would be to perform the transitive closure of the local dependencies connected with the global dependencies for our slot that we had on the right-hand side. We had an L here. We have already redecorated our the relations that we have gotten from the relations for L, which are these two. Now they are connected with the local dependencies, and what we do now is we perform the transitive closure of all the relations that are now in there. And what can we say here? At that point, we should probably also check for cycles. And now, bang, we see now that we have plugged in all the relations that we have gathered so far for L, we have seen that there is actually an edge here between K and J, and a new edge between I and H. And these two edges actually complete the circle that has already been there, at least in part. And now we can go full round on all these attributes of the children's attributes of the syntax tree. And yeah, our cycle test would say, well, there might be a cycle in practice. Abort. We couldn't prove that the whole grammar is actually strongly acyclic. So that's the end of our algorithm here. Just to show you how we would actually continue from then on, I'll just continue with what would then for the whole dependency graph follow. Then we would just apply the projection just on the parental attributes, and you see in this case the circle would go away, so that's nothing to do anymore with the cyclic check that we have performed. That would be the step for integrating that into a further larger system of equalities. And with that we I think this one. Yeah, and by performing the transitive closure and projecting out everything except for the parental nodes, we just see that there's no further dependency added to this, so the set of global dependencies for S is just empty. Okay, so far so good. That's the strong acyclic grammar test. Now, what we've talked about is that this is just a kind of approximation on the real thing, which would be the acyclic grammar test, and in which way are we over-approximating? Well, what we are actually doing is that we join all the possible values for a certain right-hand side symbol and put it in at the same time in order to perform our construction of the global dependency graph, which is just not what is in reality happening. If we look at what actual derivation trees of our grammar can look like, well, we only have two of them. We will have one that goes from S to B at the end, and from S to A at one point at the end. And if we look at both of them, well, both of them are actually cycle-free. So there's no cycle in either of them, because what can actually happen is that just one of those alternatives is kind of active at the same time. So by putting both of them inside, what we did is we reduced the actual complexity of computing the global dependencies at the cost of preciseness, in the sense that we actually introduced too much relations between the components. But that is just a one-sided error, so to say. So if we still see that there's no circle involved in the whole thing, then we're still good. So the only thing that we did is we put in too much dependencies into the whole system. Yeah. And what you also might imagine is that what we did is we needed only one step to put in all the dependencies from the child attributes into the dependency collection for our S production. But if we would have to be precise, we would have to put them in one at a time, and would have to manage with several versions of the dependency graph, which is a concept. If we continue to do that for large grammars, this would be something that will explode in the space of dependency graphs that we have to look at. So there's just an exponential number of combinations that we will get from that, because we have to, for each of the symbols that can appear at the right-hand side of production, we would have to combine them with all of the so far captured dependencies of the other children or the other right-hand side symbols, and that's just giving you your combinatorial explosion. So that's what the difference between strong acyclic grammars and just acyclic grammars actually are, or is. Okay, is there any questions so far? Okay. So, I think that's, I think it's not enough time left to get the rest of the chapter, so I would say let's end a little bit earlier today, and we'll see next week again. So thank you for your attention, and goodbye.